Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'd like to wish you all a very happy and peaceful New Year. In a few moments, you can hear all about the origin of some of our best-known Christmas carols. But first, Giobbe Villacqua presents There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins with the Gospel reading for the Feast of the Holy Family.
The parents of Jesus used to go every year to Jerusalem for the Feast of the Passover, and when he was 12, they went up for the celebration as was their custom. As they were returning at the end of the feast, the child Jesus remained behind, unknown to his parents. Thinking he was in the party, they continued their journey for a day, looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. Not finding him, they returned to Jerusalem in search of him. On the third day, they came upon him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. All who heard him were amazed at his intelligence and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you done this to us? You see that your father and I have been searching for you in sorrow." He said to them, "Why did you search for me? Did you not know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not grasp what he said to them. He went down with them then, and came to Nazareth, and was obedient to them. His mother, meanwhile, kept all these things in memory. Jesus, for his part, progressed steadily in wisdom and age and grace before God and men.
It's only since 1969, when the revised Roman calendar was published, that the Feast of the Holy Family has been celebrated on the first Sunday after Christmas, or Sunday in the Octave of Christmas. It's a feast which has a particular history. Quite recent in time, it is to be regarded, write the liturgists, as either a devotion feast or an idea feast. And to understand what that means, we have to go to the Manual on the Liturgical Year, where we find that since the Middle Ages, a special group of feasts has been celebrated, the Feasts of Ideas.
These do not focus on particular events of salvation, but have as their object truths of faith, special aspects of Christian teaching and piety, or various titles of the Lord, his mother, or a saint. Idea feasts are also called devotion feasts. They had their origin in private devotions, and only gradually acquired a place in the universal festal calendar.
It seems that the cult of the Holy Family spread around the world in the 19th century, with Canada as the main source of influence, we read. It was promoted especially by Leo XIII. The family of Nazareth was regarded as a model and source of help for the beleaguered Christian family. From 1893 on, the feast could be celebrated on the third Sunday after Epiphany, if dioceses and religious orders requested it. Then Pius X temporarily suppressed it in 1911. But in 1920 it was reintroduced, appearing in the Missal now on the first Sunday after Epiphany. A checkered history for a feast which, for the beleaguered Christian family of our own time, seems even more apt. While in Cycle A we had the flight into Egypt, and in Cycle B the presentation in the temple, today's Gospel features the event recalled in the third dolor or sorrow of Our Lady, the loss of Jesus for 3 days, and that of the fifth joyful mystery of the Rosary, the finding of Jesus in the temple. The temple played an important part in the life of Israel because the temple was considered God's own house in the midst of his people, we read in a Bible handbook. And in the optional psalm for today's feast in year C, there are these lines.
How lovely is your dwelling place, Lord, God of hosts! My soul is longing and yearning, for the courts of the Lord. They are happy who dwell in your house, forever singing your praise.
In the old liturgy for this feast, these lines appeared in the introit, while the gradual opened with the first 4 lines of this verse from Psalm 26 or 27.
One thing I ask of Yahweh, one thing I seek, to live in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to enjoy the sweetness of Yahweh, and to consult him in his temple.
The distinguished first century Jewish philosopher Philo gives this eyewitness account of the scene, and in particular the spirit in which devout Jews approached the temple on the occasions of the great feasts.
Countless multitudes from countless cities come, some over land, others over sea, from east and west and north and south at every feast. They take the temple for their port as a general haven and safe refuge from the bustle and turmoil of life, and there they seek to find calm weather, and released from the cares whose yoke has been heavy upon them from their earliest years, to enjoy a brief breathing space in scenes of genial cheerfulness.
We might be somewhat doubtful as to whether the temple was a refuge from bustle and turmoil when we consider the numbers that converged on it. In the time of Nero, the governor of Syria, to convince the emperor of the importance of the Jewish nation, once counted the sacrificial lambs during the Passover. They were 256,500. As the minimum number for each lamb eaten at the feast was 10, the total number of pilgrims that year was calculated at 2,565,000. But scenes of genial cheerfulness there certainly would have been. The Jewish Passover, writes one, was a happy, tumultuous feast, the great experience of the year. A note by the scholars helps us to understand this enthusiasm.
Israel's worship was marked by awe and thanksgiving, hope and gratitude. Even though this worship was not always faithful, Israel did experience the blessings of God's promises. It was this confident hope that brought such exuberant joy to their celebrations. I rejoiced when I heard them say, "Let us go to God's house, and now our feet are standing within your gates, O Jerusalem."
The three most important feasts for the Jews were Passover, which included the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles, or Booths. Hebrew law required that all males appear before the sanctuary of the Lord during these pilgrim feasts, as they were called, for obvious reasons. But this obligation only applied to those who lived no more than a day's journey distant from Jerusalem. Nevertheless, the crowds that poured into Jerusalem for these pilgrim or foot festivals were enormous, especially at Passover.
Jews came not only from every part of Palestine, but from the great Jewish quarter of Alexandria, and even from Europe. Gentiles from all lands also flocked to Jerusalem out of curiosity, because it was the great time to visit the city.
Thus a modern writer, who might well have been talking of the crowds here in Rome in Holy Week. And then we have the account in the Acts of the Apostles of the Pentecost crowds.
Devout men of every nation under heaven, Parthians, Medes and Elamites, people from Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya around Cyrene, as well as visitors from Rome, Jews and proselytes alike, Cretans and Arabs.
The list certainly seems endless. And what of our pilgrims from Nazareth? The Gospel tells us that the parents of Jesus used to go to Jerusalem every year for the Feast of the Passover, probably only on that occasion, for they certainly lived more than a day's journey away, three or four, more likely. On this occasion we read that Jesus was with them. Did he come on previous occasions? We don't know. But it was quite possible. Younger boys, writes one, though under no obligation, often went up to the temple on these feasts, as did women, though they were not obliged to either. And another writer comments.
The children considered the trip to be a kind of vacation, full of adventure and excitement. They counted it a privilege to go. Jerusalem was full of new sights and sounds that they were eager to experience. Often the children became so anxious to reach Jerusalem that they ran ahead of the slower adults.
And this last piece of information is particularly interesting when we consider what happened on that historic Passover. But let's follow the pilgrims from their starting point.
They would have joined a large party in Nazareth at the start of the journey and linked up with others when they reached the main road to Jerusalem from the north. In those days, the road they took was about 90 miles, and they probably spread the journey over 4 days. Their party would not travel in any fixed formation. Some would move faster, some slower. People would travel with one group of friends today, a different group tomorrow, a third group the day after. Only at the end of each day would families and friends reassemble.
Coming from the north, as they did, the Holy Family and their group would probably have entered Jerusalem by the Damascus Gate. Then they would have made their way to the temple, which was reached by underground stairways, passing through the porticos into the huge outer court, or court of the Gentiles, where Jesus would have seen the money changers and those selling animals for sacrifice. Here, perhaps, Joseph and his group would have bought the lamb for their sacrifice. On the afternoon of Nisan 14, the day of the first spring moon, the paschal lamb was sacrificed in the court of the priests, either by the head of the family or of the group, when a number of families united. There had to be no fewer than 10 and no more than 20 at the paschal meal. After the sacrifice, the crowds would disperse to their homes, lodgings or tents, to make ready for the feast. As H.V. Morton writes,
"We can imagine how the tremendous activity, the bustle and the excitement of the afternoon was succeeded by a Sabbath stillness as the sun fell. The streets would be empty. The smell of roasting meat would rise up over Jerusalem and spread even to the hills around. The last light of the sun would rest for a moment on the white marble of the temple, touch the golden spikes on the Holy of Holies, and then vanish. And with darkness, the oven fires on the Mount of Olives, where the Passover tents were pitched, would glow like rubies."
Did the Holy Family lodge in a tent on the Mount of Olives? It's a tantalizing thought. With their limited means, it seems logical that they would have been with the hundreds of pilgrims camped round the walls of the city in tents. The week goes by with all its impressive ceremonies. On the second day, another important one was the consecration of the beginning of the harvest, when a priest waved a sheaf of first ripe barley before the Lord. And throughout the week, only unleavened bread was eaten. Luke tells us nothing of this, but what he tells is significant. When he was 12 years old, they went up for the feast as usual. In the period between his 12th and 13th birthday, a boy fell under the obligation laid on all menfolk to present themselves before God in the place of his choice. On this occasion, Jesus was 12 years old. But we read,
"Next year, when he would be 13, Jesus, as firstborn son, would be under obligation to fast the whole day in memory of the firstborn sons who had not perished when the angel of death passed over their houses in Egypt."
The festival over, the pilgrims strike camp and the caravans move off, divided as usual into groups of men and women.
As we have seen, pilgrims might shift from one group to another. Boys would quite certainly have darted about more than their elders. The road was so crammed with people on the move that there was no telling who was there and who wasn't. The road from Jerusalem to Nazareth descends from the mountains on which Jerusalem is enthroned into a blinding, burning valley, now up and now down, and always rising or falling in a series of double hairpins. The road goes on through the yellow hills into the country of the tribe of Benjamin.
"And on each one of these hills," writes our traveller, "is a village whose name is known to millions of people, the little villages of the Old Testament. But there is one village in particular which catches his attention, not surprisingly.
I came to a little village called El Birei, which, it is said, was the place where Joseph and Mary missed Jesus on their return from Jerusalem to Nazareth. They retraced their steps and found their son disputing with the elders in the temple. This incident, which is given only by St. Luke, has often been questioned by the higher critics. Some writers have considered it inconceivable that parents would not have missed a child during a day's march. On the spot, however, the explanation is very simple. A day's march in the East is generally the distance covered in 7 hours of slow travel. But the first day's march by caravan was always a short distance, because these large and confused assemblies were often late in starting. On the main roads around Jerusalem are ruined khans, or inns, only a few miles from the city, which mark the first short day's march. El Birei has such a ruin. It was here that the Nazareth caravans rested and spent the night before setting off in earnest on the following morning."
Today, the village of El Biray is marked on the map as Al Bira, Beeroth in brackets, and it is right on the main highway to Jerusalem. A few miles to the west is Ramallah. In the coloured photograph in my illustrated gospel, it's shown with a mosque, and the inscription reads, Beeroth, on the caravan route from Judea to Galilee, the fountain near which the caravans used to halt. And our traveller concludes.
What could be easier than that Joseph and Mary should have missed Jesus in the confusion of an Eastern departure? He was then 12 years of age and would probably have been in the habit of travelling with other boys of his own size. How natural that, as the caravan wound its way out of Jerusalem, his parents should have assumed that he was with them. Jesus was, I feel sure, not the only boy who's been left behind in Jerusalem during the hectic departure from a festival.
But this was no ordinary boy. During the feast, the rabbis were expected to be available to all the faithful and were usually to be found under the porches of the temple or in one of its courts, ready to answer any questions concerning the law, and particularly to teach the young people the history of Israel and the prophecies concerning the Messiah. We don't know what Mary and Joseph heard when they found Jesus after 3 days' search, in the temple, sitting among the doctors, listening to them and answering them questions. We're only told that all those who heard him were astounded at his intelligence and his replies. The whole episode, writes one, is mysterious. Mysterious with great gleams of light, but a profound darkness as well. The apparent harshness of the child's answer to his mother, the whole enigma of his staying on in Jerusalem without telling them. His mother stored up all these things in her heart. And on that questioning note, let's close with these lines from Tom Gunn's poem, Jesus and His Mother. My only son, more gods than mine, I do not understand your words. I taught you speech, we named the birds. Yet I remember how you went to speak with scholars in furred gown. Are you the boy I bore alone?
And our thanks there go to Jobe Vilakwa for this edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now moving on in the broadcast.
We all like singing carols at Christmas, but we often don't know their origin. Music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore helps us out.
The joyful news of Christ's birth has inspired Christians throughout the centuries to sing the praises of God. Christmas carols are among the best loved of all forms of sacred music. In England, carols were very popular in the later Middle Ages. One of the few that has survived more or less intact over the centuries is the Coventry Carol. Many carols use folk melodies, so it's quite hard to say just how old they are. In their present form, they're usually from the 19th or 20th centuries. That's to say, they were discovered and arranged for publication and popular use in recent times. One of the great pioneers of research into English folk song was a man called Cecil Sharp. Here's a Christmas carol that he discovered for us at Chipping Campden in Gloucestershire.
The holly and the ivy, when they are both o'ergrown, of all the trees that are in the wood, the holly bears the crown. Oh, the rising of the sun, and the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organs, it's singing in.
Another important figure in the rediscovery of English folk songs was Ralph Vaughan Williams. He was also interested in hymns. In fact, he composed a number of well-known hymns himself, and he edited the English hymnal. one of the Christmas carols we associate with him, uses a folk melody that he discovered in Sussex, still known today as the Sussex Carol. After the Reformation in England, carol singing more or less died out. Certainly there was no place for carols in the Reformed liturgy, because it was forbidden to sing non-scriptural texts in church. This meant no hymn singing at all, except for the Psalms. One of the first Christmas carols to establish itself in England after the Reformation was While Shepherds Watched. And of course, if you look closely at the text, you'll see that it's practically all taken from St. Luke's Gospel. So it was the first Christmas hymn, and for more than 80 years, the only one permitted to be used in Anglican churches. Meanwhile, the English Catholic community was either underground or in exile on the continent. One of the major centres was Douai in Flanders. At the English college in Douai, priests were trained to serve on the English mission. And here came to birth one of the most famous of all Christmas carols, O Come All Ye Faithful, or Adeste Fideles, to use its Latin title. Both the words and the music are attributed to John Francis Wade, who was a professor there during the 18th century. It was first published in England in the 1780s, and it's been a firm favourite ever since. Many of the carols we sing today are of German origin. In fact, so too are many of the traditions surrounding our celebration of Christmas, such as the Christmas tree or Tannenbaum. Like their Anglican counterparts, the Lutheran reformers encouraged hymn singing. Listen to the traditional German carol Es ist ein Rose entsprungen, associated with the 17th century Lutheran composer Michael Praetorius. One of the best loved of all German carols is In Dulci Jubilo. The text is half in Latin and half in German. J.S. Bach used the tune in a choral setting and also in some of his organ chorale preludes. but it's best known to English-speaking congregations in a 19th-century arrangement by Robert Pearsall, which is half in Latin and half in English. Probably the best-known German, or rather Austrian, carol is Stille Nacht, or Silent Night. This was written on Christmas Eve 1818 for the village church in Oberndorf, just north of Salzburg. Since then, it's taken the world by storm. By the 19th century, hymn singing had come to be accepted in the Church of England. Members of the Wesley family produced many of the new hymn texts. Charles Wesley's Christmas hymn, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, was matched with a tune by Felix Mendelssohn to produce one of the best-loved of all Christmas carols. Mendelssohn had originally written the tune for secular words, and he wasn't sure it would work with a sacred text. He needn't have worried.
And you were listening there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Warm thanks go to him for sharing with us his musical expertise. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Laudetur Jesus Christus.